Hey, it's your pal Mike Shea of SlyFlourish.com and guest writer for the Emmy Award-winning website Critical Hits. Today I'll be talking with Eric Scott DeBee, author and game designer for Wizards of the Coast. Eric is a co-author on Shadowfell, Gloomrot and Beyond, and the Neverwinter campaign setting. He is also the author of Shadowbane, available in ebooks everywhere, and his next novel, Eye of Justice, will be coming out in September of next year. Today, Eric and I talk about sandbox gaming. We talk about how DMs can create an open-ended game that gives players the freedom to explore a small city or a large world without being forced down one path or the next. This podcast is an hour long, and I hope you enjoy it. So I like to start these off by getting right into useful tips that Dungeon Masters can walk away with if they only happen to listen for like 5 minutes of the hour that we'll be speaking. In regards to sandbox gaming, what are your three favorite tips for running a sandbox game?
Well, I think the key to running a sandbox game is communication. Keeping an open dialogue with your players, paying attention to how they're running their players at the table, and also reading, you know, things that they've written about their backstory. I've found that in my experience as a DM and as a player in sandbox games, people sometimes write a certain backstory and then play the character in a different way. Like, so mm-hmm. The character concept evolves, and you have to stay on that same page to see where the character's going as much as what the character is supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. So you're constantly trying to sort of adapt your game to match the characters. And a certain amount of communication and a certain amount of attention that you pay to the characters is essential for that. Also, since sandbox games can basically go any direction they want to go, it's kind of controlled chaos, and you get to decide how much control you're going to put on. And sometimes you put no control on, and then games can just go wherever. You need to know a lot about your setting that you've chosen, or be willing to just make shit up, because that's part of what DMing is. So, yes, attention and communication and improvisation, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. would be the three big ones.
So following up on a couple of things, when you have people, I actually, in one of the games that I'm playing in, my character's background how I've been playing him has changed a lot. You know, I played him as a very traditional druid that liked trees and nature and didn't like society. And he has turned kind of into a gold farmer. You know, he's all about the loot and the treasure now. And when he had an opportunity to dig into the Underdark, he jumped right after it. So I feel that idea that the background changes. Is it it's a little bit of a loaded question, but you know, what should the DM steer that at all, or should the DM really just go with whatever direction the player happens to be going with the character?
I think the DM should go with the direction that the player infuses into the character. Sometimes the player will ask you about how they're doing with the character and maybe say, oh, you know, I'm seeing the character running in this particular direction, but I also wanted to do this with the character. Like, for instance, say you had been playing your druid and you found that you were turning into this gold farmer and you weren't happy with it. Mm-hmm. Part of the issue is just how you're playing the character, but also part of the issue is what situations the DM is putting you in. So you could go to the DM and say, hey, you know, I'm having this issue running my character, and I'd like your help to put us in more situations that would be more druidy. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be more traditional and less about the loot. Mm-hmm. And then as a DM, you'd be receptive to those sorts of requests. And that's part of the whole communication issue that's important. Right.
For improvisation, I think improvisation is an easy thing to say, and a hard thing to do. Do you have any tips for how people who might not be real good at thinking on their feet in these situations, you know, things that they can do to kind of prepare for improvisation, if such a thing is possible?
Indeed. Well, it's kind of tough for me because I'm an improvisational DM. That's just kind of my style of doing it. I've always played D&D that way. Mm-hmm. And my games that I run today, I do almost no preparation for. Like, I think about what's going to happen in the game on the way over to the session. But some tips for helping plan some improvisation if you're not necessarily that good at it, just thinking on your feet. It helps to have a list of potential NPCs, just like a name and like a class and a race, who might show up at any given time, and you can just throw them into any situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have a list of 10, and you know, then the players go into a tavern and you have a list of 10 tavern names, so you just slap one on.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a list of 10 NPCs, you just pick one of them. You can even roll if you want and have it be random. And then it's that NPC. So it could be, you know, the mercenary captain. It could be the, you know, the nymph who is turned to go live in the human world, etc. And it can make for a pretty cool game that just kind of flows out. And it can create some interesting role-playing situations that you never expected. And players will pick up on that and go, wow, this is really neat, or wow, this is really crazy. Let's go somewhere else.
Right, right.
And all of that is good improvisational work.
Yeah.
So having the prepared lists is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I always suggest reading a lot when you're running games, or when you're playing games, or when you're writing games, or when you're designing games. I basically suggest reading a lot when you're doing anything regarding gaming. But as a DM, if you read a lot of novels, not just fantasy novels, but also science fiction and mystery and even, you know, just straight up literary novels,
mm-hmm.
You can draw on that sort of thing. Find a character that's really interesting, or find a plot that's really interesting who's been in your head, and just steal stuff. Just put it in your game.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe someone who has read the same novel will know, oh yeah, I recognize that guy. But most of the time, people will be completely surprised.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the most effective little thieving moments are from novels that have nothing to do with fantasy at all. I mean, if you were running, say, an Eberron game, and all of a sudden the characters need to run into an NPC, so you say, I'm going to put Indiana Jones in. That mm-hmm. might fit into the setting. But then if you say, I'm going to put Miss Marple in,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden you have this mystery that, you know, Miss Marple has to be working on, and she's just sitting there with darning her socks and pointing out things that the PCs are missing. So,
right, right.
And that's really memorable, I think, from the other side of the table, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I keep a list of NPCs. I found a generator online that generates, you know, NPCs with kind of random, small random backgrounds and good
names.
Yes,
online generators are your friend.
Yeah, and that was, I think the only trouble I had with that is I would forget which one I had used, or I'd lose the notes, and then they'd run into the guy. They're like, let's go to that bar and talk back to that guy. And I'm like, oh man, you know, I totally don't remember who that guy was.
This is an important part of improvisational DMing or sandbox DMing. Is to keep notes.
Yeah.
When you make stuff up on the spot, you need to make a note of it because it will come back up.
Yeah, that's a big failure of mine. I'm terrible at I'm terrible with names. I can never remember names, even the guys I made. And I can never, I don't keep notes at the table. All the notes I have are notes I've already pre-written, which isn't really useful when things change.
Indeed. Sometimes your players will help you out with it.
Yeah.
You could say, oh, yeah, we're going to go. Better you guys are going back to that tavern. Do you remember the name of that of the innkeep? And they're like, oh, yeah, this person.
Sometimes I'll just make up a new name and nobody notices. So,
right. Too. And that could be fun,
and
too.
And then I don't write that one down. And it's just a vicious cycle.
And, of course, if you completely forget an NPC and there's no way you're going to come up back up with the name, just say that person died and is replaced by someone else.
Yeah,
it could have been an awful murder. They could have been dragged off and killed by monsters.
Yep.
Who knows?
Yep.
I mean, this is fantasy.
He had a digestive disorder and died. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, and on material, I've always been a big fan of stealing material from. I like 1 hour HBO style dramas, and
oh yeah,
you know, I've been stealing a lot of characters from that, and I'll create like a little character log of you know, side characters from TV shows that I like, that I will, you know, use as a template for an NPC. I won't necessarily use their name, but I might use their appearance and I might use some of their background. And nobody, you know, because they're all modern, you know, TV shows about, you know, meth dealers and stuff, there's no, people are not going to get the connection. You know, it's too, if I pulled them from a fantasy novel, they probably get it. But if I pull it from Sons of Anarchy, they have no idea.
Or Breaking Bad, which
Breaking
is
Bad,
a great
yes.
source.
Yeah, Mike the cop from Breaking Bad, you know, the ex-cop who now works for the mafia guy, is one of my favorite characters in that show. And I use him as, you know, the lackey, you know, the hardcore, grizzled, scarred, you know, lackey to many of the villains that the PCs say.
Tuco has showed up in one of our games.
Yeah, Tuco
it's be a just good pretty one. Much him, except he's a vampire.
Absolutely crazy. Yeah, he for the vampire twins, and he'd make a good one for one of the two.
Yeah,
one of the two vampires of the Charnel Fangs.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. I have to make a note of that now.
Keep notes.
Scare some players to death.
Oh man, he's just nuts. Yeah. So you talk? Do you run a weekly game, or are you in a weekly game?
I am actually in several games. One of them is a weekly game. I play in that one.
Gotcha.
And I play in two other bi-weekly games, like every 2 weeks, that mm-hmm. kind of trade off. Mm-hmm. And I run a every other week game.
Wow.
I used to run more, but I've gone through this period of wanting to play a lot. So
yeah.
It's worked out pretty well.
Good. You mentioned that you do hardly any prep, so this question may be short. What sort of prep do you do? So how much time, you know, overall do you spend preparing for your biweekly game? And where is that time spent? You know, where do you think a DM's time, where is your time spent? And then where do you think it ought to be spent for most people?
Well, I know that I have a good amount of design chops, so I know how to improvise monsters. Just put them on the spot. I know what their modifiers and damage should be. Mm-hmm. I don't need to use the monster builder beforehand to make up my own monsters. Mm-hmm. I think it's very helpful to breeze through the books and look for a monster that fits your concept, though, because you have your own set of, like, ooh, these are cool powers. Like, mm-hmm. my power set tends to be I slide people a lot, or I, you know, knock people down and slide them a lot.
Right.
But, I mean, if you look in the monster manual, you'll see monsters that have all sorts of different tactics that you hadn't thought of yourself. So I think those are really helpful. Mm-hmm. It's good to spend some time before a game just breezing through and looking through what might fit your concept. Generally, the best guide I've found is the character level. Just look at what level your characters are and find monsters that are maybe one lower, maybe three higher. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you can always reskin monsters to fit whatever concept you want.
Right, right.
I think I'm running a 4th edition Forgotten Realms game, and I sent my characters up against one of those awful plague changed monsters, like from first generation plague changed creatures, mm-hmm. that they were not supposed to defeat it, but they rolled really, really well, and they did. But I just used a pod demon, which I think is from Monster Manual 2 or Monster Manual 3.
Right.
For that. And it made perfect sense. It would just spawn these, you know, personifications of disease that they would then have to fight, and it would then explode all disease all over them.
Right.
And it was a little gross, but it was a memorable encounter.
Sure, sure. That's cool. Where else do you spend time when you're prepping your game? How do you... You know, you said you kind of get an idea about where you think the story's going to go. Do you... How much time do you put into something like that? As you said, you kind of do it on the car ride over.
Well, I spend some time thinking about the characters and where the players sort of want to go with them. Like, I have a dialogue with the players. When they started out, I said, so what's your concept for your character? And that was pretty much enough for heroic tier. And then in Paragon, I was like, so how is your character famous? Mm-hmm. What is your character driving toward? Right. And then they would come up with some ideas, and I'd put them into my own game. So I do some time thinking about those things. And I think about connections between the characters. Like, it was revealed about a third of the way through my game that I'm running that two of the characters were half-siblings. And they were like, well, that makes sense, right? Because they've been fighting all the time before that, and then they had slowly, gradually become friends, and one is an elf and one is a half-elf, and, you know, it's like, we saw that coming. But yeah, that's pretty cool. And then some of the characters become rivals or become great friends. And you need to, you know, kind of, you think about how that's going to go and how their stories are going to weave together. So I would say that I spend quite a bit of time thinking about that. And I plan out nemeses for the various characters, some of which die the first time they appear, mm-hmm. some of which manage to escape and recur.
Right.
And sometime along through the game, I come up with sort of the main story that I want everything to tie into.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all spawned from who the characters are, what they're trying to do, and where they see themselves progressing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And I plan out NPCs, and I think up powers and such. And I have write-ups of the main bad guys who show up in my game.
Right, right.
So there's some time spent building that, too.
Right. You mentioned NPC lists as a good tool for sandbox gaming. You also mentioned using monster books to either reskin, you know, find monsters that are of the appropriate level and have the right themes to them, and then reskinning those to fit the monsters you have. Are there any other tools and, you know, physical tools that help with a sandbox game? Like, how do you do poster maps? Do you use dungeon tiles, or do you do a markers on a dry erase or wet erase, or what other tools do you have to kind of help you prep for that game when you show up?
Well, for maps and stuff, I do a combination of things. I often use the wet erase boards, but I also use the dungeon tiles sometimes because they give you a cool inspiration that you weren't thinking of
mm-hmm.
before. I have several of them, so I pull out the wilderness box and I'm like, oh, excellent. I should have them fight outside. Hey, mm-hmm. look at this tile. What's this skeleton?
Right.
Oh, I guess they're fighting giants. Hey, cool. Mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. whatever ate the giant.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. That would be neat. I find that it's very helpful when doing a sandbox game, hearkening back to that communication idea, is to sort of discuss with the characters where they might be headed. If they're stuck in a city and they're doing plots in that city, it's a safe assumption that they're going to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to be building maps and stuff that have to do with that city. But if you end a session with, now we're going to go somewhere else, it's helpful to know sort of generally where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. So you can start thinking about what sort of map supplies you're going to need.
Right.
And sometimes I personally like to run games that are very roleplay intensive. So sometimes there's not even combat at all
right.
in one of my sessions. And yeah, I've pretty much always been like that. I've played multiple editions, second, third, now fourth, and I have been very happy to do almost all roleplay almost right. all the time.
Right. Yeah, I think
works out pretty well, although they like killing things occasionally.
Yeah, my group would probably have a revolt. You know, if I ran a game that's all role playing, I'd have three people that are on their Blackberries and or asleep the whole time.
Well, I do.
They like combat.
Yeah, I'll have like one session that's all role play, and then like four sessions that are fairly combat intensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, it can be done, and it's good to get a feel for what your group wants and
right.
what they're like as
right.
players,
right.
which is just general good DM advice, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's just important to know your players.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I had a lot of luck with I've been using the full-size poster maps a lot more recently for the stuff we've been doing in Gloomrot. And it works nicely because they're nice and detailed, and there's lots of, you know, environmental effects and lots of terrain that I can use. And I have a fair bit of them, so I can usually find one for different areas that they might go to. But if they don't go to it, it's not a big deal. I can just fold it up and put it away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's worked really well. And some of them, like, you know, a stable can be used for a lot of different things. I think I used a stable as a bathhouse for a Dark Sun campaign that I ran.
Cool.
And it just works. You know, it's nice to whip out that stable, and each of the stalls is, you know, the private bath of a bathhouse.
Nice.
So, yeah, so I find that works pretty well. Do you put together, you know, you said that there are some times where you'll look through like the wilderness set. Do you have an idea when you go in of potentially what encounters are going to run, or do you purposefully try to avoid pushing them in a certain direction and not necessarily spending any time in figuring out what kind of encounters they're going to run into?
Well, sometimes I have a pretty good sense. Like, if my heroes are out after, you know, a big villain that's fleeing away, like that plague change monster I was talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
Then I know that they're going to fight it at some point, and they're going to be chasing it through a heavily wooded area. So if I wanted to run a quote unquote random encounter, although no encounter in 4E is ever random, because why would you do that to your
right,
game?
An hour and a half of, hey, yeah. You ran into five guys.
Then I would pick monsters that were appropriate for that area. If the players are just going to go off somewhere and I'm not sure what they're going to do, then I bring like a collection of monsters that they could run into theoretically, and just kind of easy battles that I might throw in just to spice things up. If they're going to, say, Neverwinter, then I might bring orcs and say that the orcs are raiding, right? And a settlement outside of Neverwinter as the characters approach, right? And that may show up later in the game or it might not. As well as bringing things that are specific to Neverwinter. So I might bring, like, you know, were-rats, and I might bring human guardsmen type people for the players to then interact with. If they go, well, you see this village is being raided by orcs, but we can't really do anything about it. Let's go get the guard. Which PCs never do that sort of thing. Yeah.
So one of the things, like, you know, for some groups that aren't traditionally used to a sandbox game, they're more used to having a, you know, a story and then a story that leads to encounters and maybe some skill challenge-y kind of things, but they're all relatively linear. How do you start to get them to think more of, you know, think more in a sandboxy way, you know, without having five people staring at you like a deer in headlights every time? They're like, I don't know, what's the right answer? I don't, you know, where do you want us to go?
That's a really good question. I think gamers run the gamut from really linear, we just like killing things, to I want to be able to do whatever I want and, you know, role play my character in whatever way I want. And then most gamers are somewhere in between those two extremes.
Right.
And so it's important to know your players, like I said earlier. And if you find that your players are mostly toward the battle end of things and not so much on the role play end of things, but you still want to kind of enrich the game with some more role playing, then it's best to introduce it to them gradually. You give them choices, right? Choices that may not really affect the game heavily, but still make an impact. Like, I don't know if you or your listeners have played the Dragon Age games. In those games, you'll have choices when interacting with NPCs that might make them like you or dislike you. And since you're only playing it through once, you hear the conversation in a certain way. But when you go and play it through again and you make different choices, the conversation still ends up the same way.
Right. Yeah.
Just the characters, you know.
Sometimes not.
Impression is a little bit different, or you might end up in a battle.
Right. Yeah. There are some decisions you can make in Dragon Age that will radically change the game.
That's right. So what I'm saying here is that give them the illusion of choice, I like to call it.
Yep.
You know, present them with some choices, even though you know the game is going to go in a particular direction.
Right.
I'll give you an example. So they're going into this evil, you know, church, okay, where this innocent girl is going to be sacrificed to a dark demon lord. Because, you know, most D&D games will get there eventually.
Oh, yeah. Good statement.
So they have three choices. One, they can just run in and attack the demon cultists. Two, they can try and talk them out of what they're doing or, like, bluff them in some way.
This is wrong.
Or three, they could do nothing.
Right.
Okay. But you, as the DM, want them to fight the demon cultists. So you just say, you give them these three choices. And if they fight, then they fight. If they talk, then they have some role playing that goes on with the cultists.
Goes nowhere, and then they fight.
But then somebody attacks. right? Somebody loses their patience and attacks or something like that. If they do nothing, then the innocent maiden gets sacrificed. Demons get summoned. They sniff out the players and they attack. So in each of those three instances, it still leads to the battle, which was what you were planning all along. But the players still feel like they have the chance to really alter what happens.
Right.
Some of those situations, some of the cultists might be convinced of their evil ways and leave. The victim might be saved in certain of the circumstances, etc.
Right, right. They might get combat, you know, they might get a surprise round if they do, you know, something particularly clever, or they may get jumped and lose a surprise round if they don't.
Right. You know? And so the players have this
but either
sense
way, they're still
they
in a fight.
Really made a difference.
Right, right.
That the game might still be going in a logical direction, mm-hmm. but that they have influenced the status quo in some way.
Right, right. Yeah, in running the, you know, so I ran a Dark Sun campaign before this one, and now I'm running Gloomrot. And with Dark Sun, I had a very clear storyline, which is, you know, that a Templar is trying to resurrect Kallak, and they need to stop him. And, you know, there was lots of different choices and lots of different ways that they could help stop him, collecting, you know, help collect artifacts before the evil guy did, whatever. But it was still a main story. And with Gloomrot, I made it much more open-ended. Like, when I created the, you know, when I sat down and said, we're going to do this, I had an initial scenario of what happened when they started, but I didn't explain why, even to myself, with the idea that they would start to explore it and eventually things would start to come clear either through their investigation or an idea would come to me or whatever. And giving them those choices at the end of the game, or, you know, giving those choices throughout and at the end of the game to say, okay, you can follow this thread that you've been, you know, that you've been following. This guy wants to talk to you and you've heard rumors of this other thing that you can explore. Which do you guys want to do? And usually they're able to vote to go in one direction or the other. And
right.
It's a little bit more sandboxy, but it's not quite on the order of you have the entire city of Gloomrot, where do you want to go? And they're like, I don't know. Yeah.
Right. The last thing you want to do when you have players that prefer those linear sorts of games mm-hmm. is say, what do you want to do?
Yeah, right.
Because then they'll go, well, we want to do whatever we're supposed to do.
Yeah, right. What's coolest? Right. Or,
right.
Or in my
or
case,
who's, you know. Who's hiring us to do something?
Right, right. I don't like, know. Somebody look like they're in trouble.
The mercenary job board is this great gaming tool. And you're like, oh, yeah, people are offering a reward for such a thing. And players are like, yes.
Does she have a, isn't there a bar in Gloomrot that's got nothing but posts all over the walls?
And mysterious cloaked strangers in the corners.
I think so. No, there's a bar that's like everybody puts like a note somewhere on the wall, and it's like a, you know, the ultimate
Indeed.
You know the ultimate you know job board for PCs. You can get involved
in
everything.
It's a little nod to that concept.
Do you use published material as a dungeon master? Like, you know, not so much the obviously the core books and stuff, but campaign source books and things like that, or do you tend to run your own worlds? What do you do?
Yes and no. I've integrated the fourth edition Tomb of Horrors book mm-hmm. into my Realms game, and
is that the current one, the one that Ari?
The current one, the one written by
Ari Marmel and
I think it was Ari and
Eric.
Steve? I'm not sure. I have it on my shelf right here. Not finding it. Anyway, but it's that book, and it's working out pretty well, although I'm finding that my players don't like puzzles as much as I thought they would.
Right.
So I'm...
Ari Marmel and Scott Fitzgerald Gray.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, I looked it up on Amazon.
Yes. It's a good book. It has some fun stuff, and the final chapter of it is very much about numerous dead gods and going to their... mausoleums, basically. And mm-hmm. I was like, well, that's perfect for a Forgotten Realms game.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's the direction that I'm going in. And it's done pretty well. I've modified it quite heavily to fit it into my own games. But, so I definitely use that. It's helpful to have some mechanical work that other people have created,
right.
Much like I was mentioning earlier about finding monsters who have things that you didn't think of.
Right. And my guess is you use them kind of as a toolbox of different things you can use at different places, or do you run them linearly?
Both. I ran the first chapter fairly linearly, although I tied in the players to it a little bit. But my players weren't terribly happy with how it worked out. They wanted more connection to their own stories.
Right.
So I'm probably going to open it up more
mm-hmm.
In the next chapter, which they haven't actually got to yet.
Right.
So they've only done chapter one.
Right, right.
But it's a very helpful tool.
Right. When you're using a published adventure, I mean, that, you know, Tomb of Horrors is a nice one because it's an actual... you know, it's an actual beginning to end adventure. I think you can kind of break it up into pieces and use it in different ways. How does that fit, and how do other traditional published adventures fit into a sandbox campaign? How can you use them in a sandbox game?
Well, part of it is that they do a lot of your work for you. This is like running a game in a shared world. There's a lot of stuff out there. If you want to set your game in the Forgotten Realms, for instance, there's a lot of creation already done for you, and you just have to pick what to use and what to ignore. And you should ignore stuff, because not everything is going to work for everybody's game.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when you're using a pre-established campaign or sourcebook or whatever in your game, you have to be comfortable using what you like and ignoring what you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of been my design aesthetic when I was working on Neverwinter and on the Shadowfell, is that I wanted to just throw a lot of stuff at you, but also suggest that, you know, you should take it and run with it rather mm-hmm. than you should run your games in this particular way.
Right.
And I think that that's the most helpful way for source books to be designed.
Right, right.
As a source of ideas and things that you can just pick up and run with, as opposed to a color by numbers, this is what your campaign should be.
Right. Yeah, I think the I wrote an article for Critical Hits a couple of years ago about ideal, you know, what the ideal adventure is for me, the thing that I wanted most. And, you know, both Gloomrot and Neverwinter hit a lot closer to what I was looking for, which was more of a toolbox for adventure things and less of a storyline. You know, that I expect, you know, most dungeon masters who want to sit down have a good idea in their mind of a story they want to tell, or can come up with one as they go. They don't need a lot of, you know, story to go across, but there's a lot of hard parts that they might not have time for, like NPC, you know, who are all the notable NPCs? What do, you know, what are some notable locations for things? Potential encounter areas, interrelationships and factions and how those relate. And, you know, a lot of the things that can take a lot of time when you're prepping a game that might not ever come into play because your party might decide to go one direction or the other. So, you know, if you're designing it, if I sat there and built out an entire world with all the stuff in it, and then the players just go, you know, into this one cave and do that, you know, now I've wasted all that time world building. Where now, right. If I want to run an adventure in Gloomrot, you know, I've got a whole setting of different things and different places they can go in Gloomrot and all the seeds that they can use. And, you know, it's all the NPC stat blocks and everything like that. And that's really handy. So I'm glad to see that trend, you know, that trend has worked well. And then, you know, Heroes of the Feywild is another one. You know, I assume you've seen it.
I paced through it briefly, but I don't actually have a copy yet.
Yeah,
I want to get one. I've just been very busy.
Yeah, it actually reminds me a lot of Neverwinter, because I kind of expected it to be a, you know, more of a you know, martial power kind of book, you know, primal power or whatever.
Right.
And instead, what I got is a book that has a lot of story in it, not nearly as much detail into specific areas and locations and NPCs that you get in something like Neverwinter, or that you made in something like Neverwinter or Gloomrot, but enough that I could say, oh yeah, you know, like the prince of the, you know, the prince of the Winter Palace, you know, that's an interesting idea. You know, let me think about building an adventure there. So there's actually a lot more for a DM in a book like that than I've seen in you know, what I would traditionally label as a book for players.
Indeed. I think Wizards in their design scheme are now moving toward more story,
mm-hmm.
less crunch.
Right.
And
right.
There's still some crunch there,
mm-hmm.
but it's my opinion that the system is pretty well and fully developed.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily need more stuff.
More powers.
Like, what we need are more, you know, character themes,
right.
and more background concepts and more, you know, inspiration for how to build a character, how to
right.
build NPCs, where to go for your adventures, things
right.
like that.
Right.
And I think that's where the design is headed these days, which mm-hmm. I find very promising. I'm very happy about that.
Sure. And yeah, I mean, I've got Gloomrot here. I'm just flipping through it. And one of the other things I like about it is I like the idea of more fluff, but I need usable fluff. you know, I think there's a difference between having three pages of background history that is written for the Dungeon Master. And like, I don't have time to read all that and figure out how it's going to play in. But the nice thing about Gloomrot, I'm sure you don't want to sit here all night listening to me talk about how awesome your stuff is. But
well, I could think of worse things.
I suppose. But it's got flavor text for every location. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, some people are, I think flavor text is one of those very polarizing topics. I think some people really like it and some people really don't. And my feeling is like, if you don't like it, you don't have to use it. And if you don't like it, you can always just read it and then make it your own. You don't have to read it. But for lazy dungeon masters like me, it's real nice sometimes to be able to just say, oh, you went to the red door? Well, let me read you the little text about the red door. And I don't have to, you know, read through a whole bunch of paragraphs of text about the red door and then come up with a new summary of it. You know, I, on the fly, I can just read the flavor text and that immediately gives people an idea and gives me an idea of what's going on. Mm-hmm. So I haven't flipped through Neverwinter enough to know if you guys did the same thing with that. But, you know, that was something in Gloomrot that has helped me quite a bit. And a lot of times, you know, the flavor is something you can read.
I don't think Neverwinter ended up going that way.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, it's a polarizing thing, and I've seen a lot of traffic both ways on people who really like it and people who really don't.
I think I don't want to don't take this the wrong way, but I suspect that Neverwinter was kind of trying to ape the style of the previous Forgotten Realms books that have come out, which is not to say that Neverwinter is like those books, right? If you have a burning hatred for those books.
No, I actually...
There are people who do.
Yeah.
But, it was... So it tries to be kind of a little gazetteer of the things that you could get in the city. And it doesn't have the short little flavor text because, well, there just wasn't room, I don't think. Right. We wanted to cram more information and useful flavor that the PCs would run into. But there's a little bit about the about characters and factions and stuff. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did... writing the little flavor text pieces in the Gloomrot book was one of my favorite parts of it.
Was it? Yeah, so that was something you enjoyed doing? I wasn't... From an author standpoint, I was interested in whether or not flavor text is something they like or not.
Definitely. I'm one of those kind of, you know, storyteller, author, designers, so...
Right.
Yeah. It worked out well. I was very happy to do it.
Right, right. So as an author of these products, do you have certain expectations as to how they're going to get used? You mentioned that, you know, people obviously need to make it their own and take the parts that work. But are there other areas that you expected people to use, you know, where you expected people to use it a certain way and maybe were surprised that they didn't or surprised that they used it a way you didn't expect?
Sort of. I mean, as I'm going through and planning out what I'm going to design, I have this kind of concept of where I'm pushing it, and I try actively not to do that too much. Mm-hmm. I don't want to push you into running a particular Neverwinter game, although in the back of my mind there's a particular Neverwinter game. Like, this is where I think this campaign would go logically, and it would be the easiest, most logical way for it to progress, which means that's how I'd run it. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that everyone is going to run it that way, and that's not necessarily going to be compelling to everybody. So as a designer, I kind of, you know, get myself to think about the different directions it could go as well.
Right.
And I just lay out some of the groundwork and suggest some deviant paths that I probably wouldn't pursue in my own game, but somebody might look at and say, oh, that's awesome, I'm going to pick that up and run with it. So, yes, I have to make kind of a conscious effort to not design exactly my game,
sure,
but design a toolbox for everyone's game.
Sure. And that actually kind of gets into that, you know, when one comes up with those three options, you know, like I do all, you know, I think more than three and people have trouble remembering what the first one was and less than three and they feel like they're getting railroaded. But if you say like, okay, you have three potential ways you can go, you know, you can do this, this, and this. And, you know, I think it's handy for, I totally lost my train of thought. I think it's useful, to have different,
options. I think people, you don't want to make those, you don't want to pick one that's your favorite as the DM. You know, you don't want somebody to, you don't want to build it out and say, oh wow, you know, that dragon sounds really cool. And you're like, yeah, that's the one I actually prepped. The other two, I have no idea. So, you know, I purposely don't plan any of those three options beforehand until they pick one, and then I'll plan it out. And that way I don't have any bias. You know, I'm not winking at them when I'm mentioning one of the ones that they're heading towards, but that can be tough. So I assume the same is true when you're designing it. You don't want to necessarily say they're definitely going to go through and fight this group, you know,
pretty much is the case. I mean, to add on to what I was saying earlier, as a designer, I'm used to doing this. So it's not like it's hard for me to come up with, you know, just putting out the tools out there. But I do keep notes to myself as to how I would run the game, you know, given my own complete freedom in doing it. If I had a very linear party that just wanted to do a linear game, I would run this particular sort of game. Yes. Sure.
Yeah. Right.
But at the same time, I try to expand everything and just put out as many things as possible to try and appeal to people. And when I'm actually running the game, I try not to push it in the way I want so much as incorporate story elements that I want.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I'm running my Forgotten Realms game, I'm going to think of one that won't be a spoiler because I'm pretty sure some of my players do listen to your podcast.
So they're the ones.
Yes, there's this one particular character who is like, you know, this sort of ancient elf trickstery guy. He shows up in my novels. His name is Lilton. He mm-hmm. shows up sometimes. But he's one of their main, not really enemies, but like NPCs that they run across. And I want him to be in the story, but I don't want to like make the players think that I'm just, you know, oh, I'm in love with this guy, so this guy is going to show up all the time. No, instead I have him do stuff behind the scenes, and he occasionally crosses paths with them, and he has his own proactive sort of goals that he's doing. Mm-hmm. And occasionally I will have the PCs run across them when their goals conflict. So I can do things that I want in the game, but if the PCs don't want to interact with them, they just kind of happen behind the scenes, and I try not to develop it a whole lot until I know that the PCs are going to cross him,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of speaking like, you know, NPCs and how that works, one of the things that I've been having a little bit of trouble with when I'm running Gloomrot is keeping track of all of the inner relationships of the NPCs and trying to keep them in my head. You know, the gal that runs the red door, whose name escapes me, of course, because I'm terrible with names. It took me a while to figure out exactly what her alliances were with the other factions in Gloomrot, and then to figure out what their interrelationships were. You know, I'm not to get into too many spoilers, but you know, it turns out that the head prince of the city also has a concubine who had a former relationship with another one, you know, member of another city, or could potentially have had a relationship with another member of another city. And that one has this connection with this other group. I actually had to do like a relationship tree.
Yeah.
Just so I could have one sheet of paper where I could look at it and go, okay, if the PCs touch this one, then they are also affecting this one, and this one.
I was going to say bubble charts.
Yeah. Right.
Just drawing little lines and...
Yeah, so and so hates so and so, or so and so could potentially be, you know, the wife of so and so, or you know, they had a former. I think there's one where one person had a former fling with another, you know, who then works for another. So I had to, you know, yeah, do you have any other than bubble charts? Do you have any other thoughts about how people that are running these can keep those relationships in their head?
Well, some people can just keep it all in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can sort of do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I do get overloaded, and I will forget about people who don't show up for a very, very long time. Not everyone, but sometimes minor NPCs. Like, players will remind me. They're like, oh, I had a relationship with this guy back in the city. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Right. Right.
That guy back in Waterdeep. I don't remember his name, but yes, he was there.
Yeah.
he might be dead now, carried by dragons. Anyway, but yes, it's... So it's helpful to take notes.
Yeah.
I think Excel is a really useful program for that too, because you could just, you know, put people in the little boxes and just cross-reference them with other people.
Mm-hmm.
Bubble charts are very helpful. Brief character write-ups that are like half a page with the character's name and then relationship to so-and-so, 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 so-and-so.
Right.
That'd be helpful. Just little notes, whatever works for you mnemonically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just started highlighting things and as I went through the book to say, like, okay, they have, you know, this tie with this house and this house has this tie with this other house. And, you know, as the PCs start to knock over the dominoes, I want to make sure the dominoes are falling in the right direction or it'll get embarrassing quickly. They're like, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense.
That was one of the things I was pretty happy about. Glimrod was that we got to put in those hooks at the end of each section.
Right. Yeah.
It's
absolutely.
Like, if you want to use this character,
right,
this could be what's going on.
Yep.
And then you have a whole adventure right there.
Mm-hmm. And I used one whole thread of that. It has become like kind of the main thread of the campaign, which is, you know, Felroth and House Felroth, which was the one of the houses that was destroyed. And, you know, there's two major locations in Gloomroth that are tied to Felroth, and then there's all sorts of interconnections with the, you know, not to spoil things, but, you know, one of the major people is still involved in Felroth, and I love that.
Yeah. I think when we were designing Gloomroth, it just kind of, a lot of the stories blossomed out of the NPCs. I think the NPCs we designed basically first. Like, we had some concept of, like, major locations in the city, like the Tenebrous Cabal and Prince Roland's Palace. We knew that those existed and had to be peopled.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, oh, let's start, you know, creating some NPCs who would work out pretty well in this game. We didn't make all of them that way immediately, but we came up with a few of them, including Prince Roland and Faria and I think I don't remember if it was Matt or Andy who came up with the Vampire Brothers, but
yeah, they're
he was
great.
Pretty happy with that.
Yeah.
And then I was like, well, we need to come up with a noble, so I'm gonna make up this Olusk Karad guy. And then there was, I think, a miscommunication as we were designing whether he was really just a guy or whether he was this horrendous, awful doppelganger sort of creature.
Right.
And then we weren't really sure what our original intention was. So, and that's not really true because I was the one who designed it. My original intention was to have that as a hook, as in he might be this.
Right.
If you want this in your game. But then we were like, no, this is too awesome. So we just.
Yeah, he's got to be. Right. Yeah, so, I haven't managed to work that in yet. They had those options and they haven't so far chased those threads down. So.
Awesome.
I don't know if that's going to happen or not. So character backgrounds, they're called backgrounds, right? The main things that we have, and I keep getting them different between backgrounds and themes.
Well, backgrounds are just a few lines description, and then you get some like feat bonus or something. Themes are more substantial. They affect your character throughout heroic tier, and you get new abilities at different levels.
Gotcha.
So you're probably talking about themes.
Themes, yeah, right. Character themes, here they are. So with Gloomroth, they obviously have a very big, prominent role in Neverwinter.
Right.
How do you see the themes driving the the story and driving the adventure or campaign in a sandbox adventure?
I think a great deal. Well, to pick on Neverwinter as an example, a lot of the story in Neverwinter comes almost directly out of those themes. You know, the Neverwinter Noble, who was just called the Noble in the character builder, but the Neverwinter Noble in the actual book.
Right.
Heir to the city that no longer has a ruling class. And his, you know, quest throughout heroic tier logically is retake the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ogmund's Faithful, to turn the page. His quest is logically to come back and reestablish what's going on and find out some of the mysteries about the city.
Right.
Harper Agent, Ben Burned, is trying to navigate all the intrigues in the city. So a lot of the stories in Neverwinter grew out of those themes. We just kind of laid down some ideas. We're like, we want to use a Harper. We want to use You know, in Uthgar Barbarian, we want to do the noble heir of the city. We want to do this dwarf who's looking for Gonfalgrim. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just kind of, I think they push the players to follow a particular sort of path. Not necessarily that the path is all lined out for them, but it gives them a starting point.
Right.
Like, this is where I am now. This is where I want to go. So I should look into this.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The noble doesn't know how he's going to become the king of or queen of Neverwinter,
mm-hmm.
but he or she is in the course of the campaign, unless there's death involved. You know, but those are your two options: destiny or death.
Right.
So.
So as a player who's playing in an adventure like this, how can they help to drive this story from the background that they picked? What can they do in working with their DM to make sure that the, that their background has a good component in the campaign?
Well, Neverwinter itself includes a lot of, it has a lot of thematic tie-ins throughout the course of the book, which are like, well, if the party includes somebody from this theme when going to this place, then this happens. Or then they also know this, or then this person hates that person, etc. So a lot of that, some of that work is already done for you if you're playing a Neverwinter campaign. Mm-hmm. But as a player, if you want to help out the DM, proposing new ideas for how your theme interacts with other themes in the party is very helpful. If you're playing a Neverwinter noble and the guy sitting across from you is playing a Brigand Dorothy spy,
mm-hmm.
right, you can create this sort of like uneasy trust relationship between you. And then the Brigand Dorothy spy could go, well, you know, I'm keeping tabs on this guy because he's going to rule the city maybe. And I would like to have the ear of the king, or I would like to kill him if he steps out of line. Right. And then the DM can incorporate that into the course of the campaign.
Right. Right.
Actually, when I was designing the D&D encounters set in Neverwinter season 6, which just finished up, mm-hmm. big fight with the dragon, it was pretty cool.
Hmm.
not that I'm biased. there was actually a little sidebar before editing, which said, if the party includes a character of a shady background, parentheses, Brigand Dorothy spy, dead rat deserter, scion of shadow,
right,
parentheses, then when meeting Lord Neverember, he subtly suggests that if some misfortune should befall the heir or a Neverwinter noble character in the party, then an additional reward will be paid only to that character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that didn't make it through editing for numerous reasons, not the least of which being that that's basically saying, let's have the party fight each other in the last battle.
Right.
yeah, but that's one of those things that could happen. And I think that when you're in a sandbox game and you want to put in betrayals and rivalries and conflicting motivations, mm-hmm. it's good to talk with the other players about that. And also talk with the DM about it. D&D has had this long tradition of, I'm going to play the evil character, mm-hmm. who is the traitor spy in the group who's just going to screw everybody at some point in the game. And that can work out great.
Right.
If you have, you know, open-minded players who are experienced gamers who are like, oh, that was so awesome. We trusted you for like 3 years and then you posed us.
My group. My group tends to like that, except for my wife, who hates it, so we don't do it.
Right. That's the problem, is that you run into a player who just hates
them. They feel that betrayal.
And then it taints your real-life relationship, yep. with that person.
Yep.
And you never want to game with them again, and you don't write the Christmas cards anymore. And you occasionally send them emails that say, you jerk.
I had to sleep on the couch one night.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even my character. It was one of the other players, and...
Oh,
it's lots of fun.
Yeah, anyway, so that's the sort of thing that you need to talk to your group about. And mm-hmm. I find that the best way, if you're really good with like meta knowledge and stuff, it's nice to just talk to the other players and say, hey, my character is you know, evil. And he has other motivations. He doesn't necessarily want to betray you guys, mm-hmm. right? But he is doing his own shady things. And then I wouldn't recommend this with players who don't do the meta thing very well. Players who will just, like, always look at that person like, you are up to something. I know it. Even though there's no reason to suspect that that character's up to something. Maybe not the best strategy. But, yeah, oftentimes players, you know, communicating with one another is very helpful in setting up those kind of inter-party issues.
Right, right. So to end up our conversation, particular to these two products, the Neverwinter book and Shadowfell, you know, the Shadowfell Gloomrot. I always call it Gloomrot because that's where I've focused my entire thing, but I understand that the title of it is not. The title of it is Shadowfell, Gloomrot, and Beyond. What should DMs not miss? Like, when, you know, as you know, the author and co-author on these products, what do you really, when you want somebody to run these, what do you want to make sure they don't miss from these? So let's start, like, you know, with the Gloomrot book. What in particular do you want to make sure people get to experience with it?
Ooh, my favorite things from Gloomrot. Well, I really like the Raven Queen stuff that's going on in Gloomrot. Mm-hmm. Like the church that's sort of in charge of the city, but not really.
Right.
And the underground cults to evil demon princes like Orcus.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I had a character who was a former devotee of the Raven Queen who was kidnapped and brainwashed into an Orcus cult. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the intrigues surrounding Prince Roland are really interesting.
Right.
You and I have actually had an email conversation about this.
Yep.
But I think that...
No spoilers. My wife listens to the podcast.
Prince Roland is an intriguing figure with a great many mysteries in his backstory.
Right.
And I think that if the players spend any time in Gloomrot, they need to stumble across those in one respect or another.
Right.
He's one of those characters who can be helpful or harmful or both to the party at any given time.
Right, right.
Because he has his own motivations and... The players aren't really that much of a threat to him, at least initially.
Right.
And until they uncover a certain number of his secrets.
Right.
And then all hell breaks loose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when, if you built up your campaign in Gloomrot to that point, then it's just a really cool way to tie everything together.
Right. Right.
I also really liked Faria, the Shadow Angel.
Yep. Yep.
Was my character that I designed. It was the first NPC that I came up with, and I'm like, yes. I think that's a really intriguing story.
Sure.
I like that sort of dark romance sorrow sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm gonna have a lot of fun with that.
And
how about for Neverwinter?
For Neverwinter, I did mostly the above ground city stuff, and I did Helm's Hold. And I think that the intrigues with the Ashmedai, the Harpers, Neverwinter, or Never Embers, political control or lack thereof of the city,
right,
is really interesting. So I think that a good Neverwinter campaign that is really true to the design that we put into the city will touch on that sort of stuff eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't necessarily have to have it. It's kind of oriented around a PC who has the Neverwinter Noble theme, but you don't necessarily need one. You could have an NPC who has this theme, or you could have one of the PCs be an heir to Neverwinter and not know it.
Right.
Right. Until very much later in the game.
Right. Right.
And I think that's a pretty cool way to put things. And again, it implies you're running up against Never Ember, who's one of those NPCs like Prince Roland, who could help you or hurt you depending on your actions and motivations.
Right.
Right. So I think that would be the thing that I would suggest that people look into about Neverwinter. And also the character themes are really, really helpful and cool and important to Neverwinter. If you're running a Neverwinter game, you should strongly encourage your players to take one of those themes. They don't necessarily have to do the backstory the idea when we were designing those was we would just write this backstory that people could just paste onto their character and go.
Right.
Right. But I mean, you feel free to tweak it and change it however you like. But the themes themselves are really good at grounding your character in the city.
Right. Yeah, I'm actually considering when I keep reading this and I want to run it next, but I don't know. There's too many good things. One of the things I'm considering is actually doing it as a random, a random roll that before we start anything else in the campaign, they roll against a chart to determine what background they start with. And then they build their character from the background. And then the story gets built from the backgrounds of the characters that they pick, and kind of letting the whole thing almost, start with a die roll. I don't know if that'll work or not, because people might be upset about getting stuck with, oh, I got to play a rogue now, and I didn't like rogues. So we'll see.
Well, I don't think, actually, the themes can be adapted to any particular race or class. Some of them have racial restrictions, but it says in the book that you can ignore those.
Sure.
In consultation with your DM. And only one of them has a class restriction, and that's the Red Wizard, because
the red Wizard and the Sky on a Shadow were two that I was looking at. It's like, if I was going to be a Sky on a Shadow, I'd definitely want to be a rogue.
Yeah, you'd probably want to be a rogue. Or an assassin. That would work out pretty well.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a, I remember I saw this at Gen Con, and I was just amazed by it. I read it on the airplane on the way home, and I'm just dying to build a campaign out of this. I think it also looks, talking about the sandbox game. I mean, it looks like a book. My initial 140 character review was that this looked like I could run the entire campaign without any prep. All I need to do is make sure that I read through the book and I read through the stuff. But, from week to week, I don't think I'd have to do any prep. The book has everything that I would need, between this and the Monster Vault and some other stuff to fill it out. Cool. It always looked like something that would really work well.
Cool.
Well, I appreciate your time. This has been very interesting and very useful. I know that sandbox gaming is something I want to investigate more. I ran one campaign that was very linear, and then I've slowly been moving over into the sandbox style.
I think it can be very, very rewarding.
Yeah, so. Yeah. My group likes it a lot. They like to have those options, and it fits my lazy DM style. It means I have to do less specific prep, but it's really good. So thank you very much for the time.
Well, you are very welcome. Thank you for having me.